very deep sharing of your experience. I actually have come up with four stages of aging from the work that I've done with people and research. Lightning strikes is the first one. And I think that many of your comments indicate that a characteristic quality of that experience is loss. There's some quality of loss. It can be when you're very young, and then that loss can crop up again at various other key times. Loss of what? Loss of, well, I'll pick up some of the words that I heard. Loss of control, loss of vigor, loss of youth, loss of possibilities, loss of love. I mean, in the case of you're losing your parents, losing your parents is an enormous loss, both of them at once in an accident. Yeah. Losing your sister, losing your parents being married, you know, your experience. So this quality of loss is sometimes enormous. Sometimes enormous, sometimes subtle. So that's the first stage. And in my case, sitting in my doctor's office at age 36 and having him tell me I had an enormous cancerous tumor in my belly, you know, the thought I had was, well, okay, I'm going to die. My life's over. 36. So that's the other side is sometimes our experience of loss isn't what it ends up being, you know. Obviously, that didn't happen. One of these days, my nine cat wise one, I'll run out, but I've been lucky so far. That was the first one. But that was clearly a big moment. So the second stage, I call coming to terms. And many of the, and let me just give you the other stages too so you get a sense of it. And the third stage is adaptation. And the fourth stage is acceptance. Maybe it's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is acceptance, you know. So coming to terms, many of you, I think, indicated that spoke, you're still coming to terms with what emerged out of that lightning. In some cases, after many, many years. In some cases, you thought you'd come to terms with it, but it came up again. Coming to terms can be a long, slow process, and it's work. It is the work of, we might say, the middle years of life. And I think it can be very lonely. I think one of the things I'm trying to do by doing this teaching and by putting out my book is to make it less lonely. We live in a youth culture. For some reason, I've become fascinated recently with Lady Gaga. You know, she's 24 years old. She had a super hit album. She's very, very smart, quite political, and has 3.6 million Twitter followers. But that's not the biggest. There are movie stars that have more than that. She's suddenly, from nowhere, one of the you know, top influential people in the world. Used to be Britney Spears. Britney Spears was at one time the top Googled name in the universe. Astonishing that I'm not the top Googled name. I think I have more to offer than Britney Spears, but you know, it's a youth culture. And now I think many of you are having the experience that I have, is I don't recognize the names of the movie stars, the singers, the people that everybody says is, it took me a while to even realize that Lady Gaga was the latest new thing. I didn't quite know who that was. When I read about her, it's actually quite a great story. You know, she's very humble, and she went to art school in New York and had some talent as a singer, and, you know, emerged and became a big star. But there's something I think we all experience in our American society in particular. There's something quite disconnected about that as the way life ought to be. Maybe that's part of being wiser, to your point, is, you know, you get older, and it isn't quite as impressive to have 3.6 million Twitter followers as it once was. What is impressive? You know, I find that I'm not as impressed as easily as I used to be. It takes a lot to impress me. But when I do get impressed, and often I'm impressed by the simplest things, like somebody being really honest, or somebody being generous, or somebody facing something really hard and being transformed in the way of doing it. Somebody who's, you know, like you, David, who've recently been retired, but finds something really marvelous to do with that time. So coming to terms means turning the losses that are inevitable. I mean, aging, from one point of view, can be defined as a series of irrevocable losses. Losses aren't so bad when you're young. Lose a job, get a job. Drop out of school, get a new school. Have a girlfriend, lose a girlfriend, get another girlfriend, you know. In talking to one of my physicians, psychiatrist, who has an older clientele, he says that this is identity as you get older is a key health factor. We don't realize it, but when you're young, our identity is always being refreshed from the outside because you're young. You don't have to think too much about how to regenerate your identity in the face of loss, because you're young. It comes to you. You know, you have friends. Companies are interested in hiring you. There are many things that happen that make the young, if any of you have children or grandchildren in their 20s or 30s, they have this sense of, quite unrealistic in my view, that things are going to be okay, the world will work, you know, I'll get what I need. I feel like a party pooper to say, well, maybe, you know, but they have that sense, and that's because the replenishment of identity, if you can follow what I'm saying here, when you're young, just comes with in the course of being young. But and that's because the losses are not irrevocable when you're young. The losses are not irrevocable. Typically, the losses of youth are not about illness. It's not about getting arthritis. It's not about losing your hearing. It's not about things that are irrevocable. It's about things that you can fix. You can try again. That's where I think, in talking to my primary physician, that menopause is so emblematic of an irrevocable loss, because there's a real before and after there that men don't experience. What he did tell me is that by the 60s, men get it. It's just a little bit of we get a little bit of a longer denial time on the whole than women, and imagine things, but by the time everybody's 60 or so, we all know, and we're all dealing with it. But irrevocable loss can feel very depressing, and it is depressing from one point of view, but what my psychiatrist friend tells me is a couple of things. One is, you can, just like a young person, older people can restore their identity. You just have to work harder at it. And with retirement, he was a young psychiatrist in the Air Force in the 60s or early 70s, at a time when the military began to realize that when career military people retired, it often was devastating. They went from a highly structured life they'd been in for 20 or 30 years to complete open-ended. I mean, it's like your experience times 20. You know, it's like you're in the military, everything is laid out for you, and then suddenly it isn't. And what they realized, and they had serious problems. They had people who went into major depressions, people who had panic attacks, people who committed suicide. I mean, it was a serious, serious problem. And at that time, they realized, you know, we've got to prepare people 3 or 4 years in advance to this loss of structure and identity. We have to have them make plans so they know who they're going to be when the loss comes. And so this is adaptation. Adaptation phase is to not to be defeated by the losses of aging, but just to recognize that we have to be proactive in establishing a new collection of identities that take the place of the ones we've lost. The research shows very definitively that volunteering, serving others, being involved in the community is very healthy. It adds years to your life, and it reduces the incidence of all these stress-related and age-related illnesses like heart disease, high blood pressure, and everything. The profile of a person who is coping well with aging is somebody who is excited to do new things and to find new things. In other words, somebody who's replenishing their sense of who they are all the time. And it's something that it's never too late to try, but the earlier you get started realizing that you have to do that, the less it'll be a shock when these losses come. The other thing, which I thought was really striking, which is definitely going to be good news for all of you, is that regular involvement in a church or a spiritual activity, on average, adds 7 years to your life. Can you believe that? 7 years to your life. So we hit the jackpot. We did hit the pot of gold. We're going to all live a long time because we're meditators and we're active. We have an active spiritual life. We have an active inner life. A lot of these research results don't tell you why. They don't know why. They just know that it's so, because they can look at various populations. So, you know, these people at Stony Brook didn't know exactly why people in their 50s were happy. They went back and interviewed them, but it was all over the map. You know, it's hard to know. It just, when you take the whole population together, you discover these things. So I'm still puzzled about, well, what is it about being involved in a church that makes you live longer? Well, I think that that's a very inspiring fact, and what it tells me is that not being alone, being connected, I'm speaking directly to Jack, to your quality of feeling alone now, because you know you're here, you're not as connected. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
you're not.
Thank you.
You're not as connected to sound as you used to be, and yet connection. Human connection seems to be a vital nutrient as we age, as much as B12 or any of the stuff they tell you. You know, human connection, not being isolated, not being alone. A phrase that very frequently comes up both with people I interview and also professionals who work with aging populations is the phrase giving back. That giving back, in a minute I'll tell you what I'm chuckling about, but giving back is really helps you age better. And in fact, one of the researchers said it was such a powerful result that they said, that if they could create a pill called Giving Back instead of Prozac, that it would be the best-selling pill in the world because it's got better, you know, benefits than Prozac or any of these other miracle drugs. Giving Back is the best antidepressant that they've been able to discover. So this is important news for all of us. At whatever level we can, you know, it can be something very simple, something, and it can just be within our family, and it's kind of a cliche and kind of obvious, you know, in a certain way, but not really. I mean, to know that this is not just a nice thing that we ought to try to do, but it's a kind of an essential thing, because this giving back or being connected or staying connected creates a new nexus of identity. You know, what the real loss that is irrevocable, not irrevocable, but the real loss that is, that makes us old, is becoming disconnected. That loss is very hard on us. And so, and as my good friend Alan Sinocchi said, maybe Alan has come and taught here, I don't know, but Alan is, you know, lifelong civil rights and peace activist, a Buddhist priest, and he said that, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was I just talking about? Yeah, before
giving
that.
Back. Giving back.
Giving back. He said that the there's, for Buddhists, and this was something that Gary Snyder flagged as early as early 60s, that you have to give back to yourself as well, not just to other people. And my psychiatrist friend, his recipe for his aging patients who come to him with problems around aging is you got to have two baskets. You got to have a basket where you're giving back outwardly, and you've got to have a basket where you're doing stuff just for yourself. Taking the trip you've always wanted to take, if you can afford it. Who can afford things now, but maybe you can. you know, my wife and I, you know, we're watching our pennies like a lot of people are, but next spring, after I turn my book in, we're going to go to the Grand Canyon. I've never been. We can drive there, so it won't cost a lot. I always think to myself, Grand Canyon, I can look at photos. But you know, some part of me is saying, I'd love to see the Grand Canyon. I've never seen it, you know. Just think of how many things in your life are like that. So there has to be a basket. He calls it the narcissistic basket, the good narcissistic basket, where you do the things just for you. Just for you, things that will, again, you can think, oh, well, it's just a trip, just seeing the, but actually, seeing the Grand Canyon is a way of restoring a certain quality of identity to me. You know, it will enrich my sense of who I am to have been there. I don't know if you get that it really is an identity issue, but you know, he says the people that don't do so well contract. They have less contact with their friends. They don't get out that much. They tend to be much more routinized in their life, just, you know, like never leaving the military. You know, just when I get up in the morning, I always do this. There was a beautiful, I don't know if people were big fans of the Cosby Show, but there was a great episode when Dr. Huxtable, which is Cosby's character, they buy a ticket for two to Paris for his parents. And his parents open it up, and they say, well, this is very nice, but it's a long way to go. You know, and, you know, we like getting up in the morning and opening the door and getting the New York Times. Of course, this dates the show, right? Who gets the New York Times on their doorstep anymore? Maybe some of you do, but I get it on my, you know, phone. But, you know, that's important to us. You know, that's our routine. You know, I have my certain breakfast that I like to eat, you know. I don't know, Paris is a long way off. So the whole show is about getting his parents to acknowledge they've always wanted to go to Paris, and they really do want to go to Paris, and they just need to get on the plane and go, you know. And the New York Times will be okay. You can get the New York, he says, you can get the New York Times in Paris. he starts to think about it, and he says, I guess you're right. I don't have to have the New York Times on my doorstep. But you know, that there was a sense that they were, his parents were starting to contract into their routines and into stuff that was familiar to them. And the basket of doing things just for them wasn't getting filled up. And, you know, even for professionals like Alan or other people that are professional caregivers, like many of you may be, your therapists or something, or doctors, there is a real danger in just putting your energy into the giving back basket. You'll burn out. You'll burn out. Because you're not maintaining that balance. It's all going to somebody else, and nothing's coming to you. One of my psychiatrist friends has a term for this, which I've never really heard out there in the world, but he says it's called ratio strain. Ratio strain. The ratio between what you give back and what you take in is just wrong, you know. And you think you're doing great things. And this is a problem with Buddhist people, you know. We're supposed to be bodhisattvas and serving the world and not worrying about ourselves. Doesn't work. I mean, I have a lot of friends who really crashed and burned and had to really take stock of what they're doing. You know, that you see divorce happen, you see dysfunctions in the personal life and so forth. So you have to have this balance. Oftentimes, I mean, retirement is a different issue than it was a couple years ago, because a lot of people lost a lot and are still having to work, and it's hard. But even if you still have to work, even if you have practical difficulties, and one of the four great fears that I'll talk about this afternoon is fear of loss of livelihood. This is an ancient Buddhist doctrine that they study. And this was being taught to homeless monks whose livelihood was a bowl. But even they were afraid. Suppose I go into the village and nobody gives me food. I could be hungry for one day, but suppose I go back and they still don't give me food. Suppose 3 days or 4 days go and they still don't give me food. I'm going to die. I'm afraid, you know. So many of us, many people in the society, I think actually are dealing with that fear. But even so, even if you're struggling, you know, to find something to put into the basket that's just for you. Generosity, metta, as you know from doing the metta practice, it begins with the home base. You know, you can't really be generous to the so-called other person until you can be generous to yourself. And people in the Judeo-Christian tradition say, oh, that's awfully self-centered, you know, you shouldn't worry about yourself. Well, we Buddhists see it a little differently, you know. We don't see ourselves as separate from other people. We're all intimate with each other just by the nature of things. So giving to yourself isn't exactly selfish. It nourishes you so that you can, you know, it's like on the airplanes they say with the oxygen masks, if you're flying with a small child, put the oxygen mask on yourself first so that you can breathe and then worry about the child. It seems counterintuitive. Oh, I have to help the child. You're asphyxiated and you're trying to help the child. You're not going to help the child. You have to put the mask over yourself and be able to breathe, and then you have the energy. So this is our view as Buddhists. So we're going to take a 20-minute tea break now. It'll be a chance for us to get acquainted, and I'll be out and talking to people, and we can chat. And after that, let's come back briefly to the room. I'll ring the bell, or Stephen or Karen will ring the bell, and then we'll negotiate how to split into three groups. Shouldn't be too hard. So thank you for your attention up to this point. I hope that it's valuable for you, and I'll see you out in the tea area. Thank you very much.